hell. Legions of hell's demons are returning, walking across its barren plain. They're of every conceivable shape and size. A few look human, most are monstrous. Some are creatures which have walked in reality, others could never have existed save in nightmare. Among their thousands are recognizable figures, Coranzon and the Merkin, Mother of Spiders. Both are soon lost in the dust, kicked up by the passage of the millions returning to the domain formerly ruled by Lucifer Morningstar. A hell now administered by the Angel Duma and the Angel Remiel.
They are coming back, Duma. Don't you want to look at them? They are your responsibility too. Duma? No? It's too late to look away.
The angels stand on the balcony of a new feature in Hell's landscape. A tall, smooth silver tower, incongruously beautiful, of simple construction, with a room at its top and a balcony all around. Remiel looks down again at the snaking trail of returning demons winding across the desolate and rocky terrain, disappearing into a hazy mountain range.
There must be millions of them. It is strange, Duma. One would think they would be pleased to be back, but this is their home after all. But no. Each of them walks as if they carry the weight of 1,000 worlds on their shoulders. But, happy or sad, it matters not.
Remiel leans on the balcony, slender and beautiful, with huge white folded wings over a simple white robe.
They are coming back. And once the demons are here, the damned will also return. The tortured must have their torturers after all. Soon the chimneys will smoke, and the ditches will run with blood and offal and tears. Soon it will be difficult to tell that anything has changed here in hell. But it has. Duma, you cannot turn your back on that.
Duma lays back, haloed head resting on an upraised arm, naked and sexless, wings spread out, gazing out over the yellow sky of hell, lost in thought. The key to hell hangs on a chain about the angel's neck.
Why do you not speak, huh? You are no longer the angel of silence. Even now, another stands in your place in the Silver City. Well, say something. No? Me. I don't suppose it matters whether you look or no. You are down here, friend, until the end of time, and so am I, rulers of hell. Answerable only to our Creator. For good or for ill, it's just the two of us.
The Sandman, Act 2, Episode 8.
Season of Mists, Epilogue, in which we bid farewell to absent friends, lost loves, old gods, and the Season of Mists, and in which we give the devil his due. The Dreaming. Morpheus's palace apartment is today configured as a large Georgian dining room. Dream leans on the mantelpiece, his arms crossed, watching grains of sand trickle through a large hourglass. The person he is waiting for is not actually late. He is just not looking forward to their arrival. He pushes his hands together, arching them, steepling the fingertips. He wonders what's keeping her, what he is going to say to her. He turns to the mantelpiece, checking the hourglass again. He turns back to survey the room. It's pleasantly formal. Down the center runs a long rectangular table with a candelabra in the middle. And his guest arrives.
Kaikul.
Kaikul is an old name for Dream, whose appearance changes according to the observer's frame of reference. In Nada's eyes, his face is a deep mahogany, with a line tattooed from the hairline down to his right eye. He looks like a warrior. His eyes are still pitch black with stars in their depths.
Hello, Nada.
This is all very awkward. There is so much that could be said, so much that is left unsaid, but the fact is that both Dream and Nada are different people now.
Kaikul, Dream Lord. Hello.
Please, be seated.
They sit at opposite ends of the table.
Are you?
Thank you.
I mean, I suppose you must be hungry.
I was very hungry for the first few thousand years. But after that, I grew used to the hunger, and it ceased to concern me as it once did. I have no true body anymore, after all. I am one of the dead. If
I had
you ever...
I'm sorry. You were going to say...
No. You first, Kaikul. I think you have something to say to me.
Nada. 10,000 years ago, I condemned you to hell. I now think... I think I might have acted wrongly. I think perhaps I should apologize. I should tell you that I am sorry.
You think you may have acted wrongly? You think perhaps you should apologize? You think? And now what? You expect me to accept that and say no more? One half-hearted apology and you've somehow kissed it all better? I spent 10,000 years in hell. I could scarcely stand in that oubliette. I burned by day and froze by night. Glass shards cut my flesh. I starved and hurt and wept and waited. All that because of you. And you think perhaps you should apologize. You! You make me sick!
You hit me, Nada. You struck me. No one may strike me, and here, at the heart of the dreaming, I ought to...
Yes? What will you do to me, Dream Lord? Send me back to hell?
No. I am sorry, Nada. You are right. What I did was foolish and heartless, and unfair. You hurt my pride, and I hurt you. I was wrong. There is nothing else I can say.
They stand facing each other by the fireplace. Nada raises her arms and rests her hands on Dream's shoulders. She stares into his eyes, looking to see what she can find there. He makes no attempt to remove her hands, but gazes back.
Oh.
They kiss. Their lips barely touching, yet they touch.
Very well. I accept your apology.
If you wish, Nada, you could stay here with me. Be my queen.
I said no to that offer 10,000 years back, Dream. I have not changed my mind. But you could give all this up, you know.
You suggested that once before, Nada. My answer has not changed. I have my responsibilities. I cannot abandon them.
So you said, a very long time ago.
Well, old love, if you will not stay with me, and I obviously will not go with you, then perhaps it is time for us to discuss your future.
In the room prepared especially for him in Dream's palace, one of the last guests to leave, the Japanese storm god, Lord Susano Ono Mikoto, looks around at the lacquered cabinets, the fine Japanese prints, and upon a low futon, a curved sword. He picks the sword up, wielding it somewhat uncertainly, then pushes it into its scabbard. He heads for the door. Lord Susano walks down a corridor in the Dream Castle. One side is piled high with small clown puppets and dolls. He tries to work out whether that was arranged deliberately for him or just part of someone's dream. He walks towards the castle gate, the sun dancing on the lake outside it. Ahead of him, the Lord of Dreams is leaning against the side of the great doorway.
Lord Susano Ono Mikoto, would you leave my palace without saying goodbye? You surprise me.
I have been summoned back to the floating bridge of heaven. I regret having to leave so suddenly. I was unworthy of your fine hospitality, Dreamweaver, but I humbly thank you nonetheless.
Unworthy of my hospitality? Yes. Yes, I think perhaps you were.
How dare you, Dreamweaver! How dare you malign my honor as a deity of the floating kingdom!
I dare because you are no more a deity of the floating kingdom than I am. Are you, Loki?
You guessed.
The Japanese warrior has gone. Loki now stands where Susano was. As ever, he is tall and thin, his eyes large and cat-like, his hair standing up like a flame. But he still wears a kimono.
Perhaps if I had realized sooner, it might have saved one of my guests some inconvenience. Poor Lord Susano Emikoto. Why him, Loki?
Because he was standing next to me while everyone was watching you and Azazel. And because I don't like storm gods. I don't know why not, I just don't. They rub me the wrong way.
So it was he who Thor carried off?
Why the hell shouldn't he replace me under the earth?
Because he was my guest also, Loki.
Well, so am I. And you're going to send me back to torture and pain until the end of my world?
I cannot permit Lord Susano to remain beneath the world in your place. He should not suffer for you.
So?
I will free Susano, Loki. I could return you to the pain and the snake and the dark.
No, please, please, no. Please.
I could create a dream image of you and leave it in his place in the cavern beneath the earth. Both of you could walk free. No one else would ever need know. I am able to do this thing.
Would you do that? Please.
If I were to do this thing, Loki, you would be in my debt. You understand this?
I understand.
Very well, Loki. Let us talk.
At my age, getting tired of one-night stands. I mean, there he is, back in Egypt. I doubt he'll give me a second thought. Well, I'll be in damp old fairy with no one to talk to but simple-minded giants and garrulous toadstools. Ugh.
In the Great Hall of the Palace, where the matter of the ownership of Hell was decided only yesterday, Cluracan, the emissary from Faerie, tall, thin, beautiful, stands with his sister, Nula, equally beautiful, vaguely supercilious, and dressed in a low-cut white shift.
I wonder if he'll write to me.
Could you read it if he did?
Dearest Cluracan, falcon, squiggly line, eye, little man holding a flail, jug, squiggle, beetle, I see what you mean.
Where is he?
I'm sorry if I have kept you waiting.
We must return to our own lands at this time, Morpheus. And from myself and my brother, our thanks for your hospitality.
Ah, sister, did I not tell you?
Didn't you tell me what?
I suppose it must have slipped my mind. Excuse us for one moment, Lord Shaper.
Of course.
Cluracan, what are you talking about?
Nula, I thought you knew.
No, I didn't. You're just covering up for yourself. You can never just come out and say something. What in the name of the Unseelie Court is the matter?
You aren't coming back with me.
What?
My Lord Shaper, I will be returning to Faerie alone. My sister Nula was a gift to you from Faerie. My queen does not expect her gifts to be rejected.
What?
I must thank you for your hospitality, my lord. I will convey your best wishes and thanks for our gift to Her Majesty.
What?
Steady now.
Cluracan, she can't do this. You can't do this. He didn't give us the key to Hell. You said, you told me this would just be temporary. Act nice, you said. Smile.
Perhaps Titania will allow you back from time to time to see your old friends and visit your brother.
If the lady does not wish to stay...
Ah, but she has no choice in the matter, Lord Shaper. Nul is all yours. A gift from Queen Titania, which you have accepted. Reject Titania's gift if you will, but the Queen will not be best pleased, and Nula herself will risk her severest displeasure.
Very well, then she may stay. I will find living quarters for her somewhere out of my way. However, if you are to remain here, Nuala, you must remove the glamour you wear. I mislike little magics in this realm.
But...
Morpheus raises his hand. He points. And Nula's face loses its radiance.
Oh.
Her figure, its fullness. Her height diminishes and her hair turns from braided blonde locks to a mousy fringed bob. Her ears are still slightly pointed. She is, after all, a fairy. But a sweet, rather than an exceptionally pretty fairy.
There.
It's been so long since I've seen your natural face, my sister.
No.
I'd almost forgotten what it looked like.
No.
There, lass. Don't cry.
Kaikul, I am ready. I have chosen the second of the choices you gave me. It seems easiest somehow.
Now, Nada. Will you not wait?
No. I am not afraid, my love. Isn't that strange? I thought I'd be afraid, and I'm not. What do I do?
Just take my hand, Nada.
I spent 10,000 years in Hell, Kaikul. I blamed you for my pain. Could I have left? Could I have walked away from that?
Perhaps.
Will you remember me, do you think?
I will always care for you, Nada.
But will I know that, Kaikul Dreamlord? Will I still remember that you care?
No.
But I shall know, Nada. I shall know.
Hong Kong, Queen Mary Hospital, maternity
unit.
BB 我们将它放在托儿所，你休息一下啦。
。
The baby sleeps peacefully among all the other newborns in the nursery. Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, appears from the shadows. His bone-white hands lift the child from the crib, cradling it tenderly.
And I will not forget you, Nada. Live a good life. You will always be welcome in the dreaming, whatsoever body you wear. Farewell.
Perth, Western Australia. The beach is mainly sand, with here and there, a lone pebble. The man sitting on the lounger is naked but for a pair of swimming trunks. He stares across the sea to the horizon, which is turning to gold as the sun sets. His blonde hair curls over the nape of his neck. On each shoulder blade, he bears a large and ragged scar. The older man who approaches is dressed in beach shorts, a faded beach hat, and an open short-sleeved shirt. One of his legs is covered in scars. He stops, leaning on a stick.
You know, I've seen you before, mate. Down the beach. Sleeping rough, eh?
I suppose that we are.
There are worse places. It can get a bit warm in the daytime, but crack a tinny, or go for a dip, and you're right as rain. I don't come down here much in the day, not me. Beaches are for youngsters in the daytime. You know, staring at all the young Sheilas with nothing to cover their never-you minds. I'll tell you this for free, mate. Any kid who tried bathing topless down here 20 years ago, we would have said she was no better than she should be.
Really? Do go on.
I come down here most evenings to watch the sunset. It's a beaut tonight, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose that it is.
You young fellas, you haven't got a bloody clue. I used to come down here with a wife and with the twins. Yeah, the twins, well, little Darren copped it in Vietnam. Sean and me, well, we both got a bit the worse for wear when we heard that news. He crashed the car, but only I crawled out. That's where I got the crook leg. See, the scars.
Yes.
And when I got out of the hospital, me and the wife, we carried on walking down here. Until she got that bloody lump in her breast, and anyway, now it's just me. I still come down here to watch the sunset. You know, almost every night it's a bloody beaut, mate. And every night it's different. And I think, I've had a shit of a life, all things considered. It wasn't fair. Everyone I've ever loved is dead. And my leg hurts like buggery. But I think any god that could do sunsets like that, a different one every night, mate, Struth, you've got to respect the old bastard, haven't you? Oh, well, I'm off. Right, if you're still here tomorrow night, I'll see you then, mate.
I may be here.
You're a pom, aren't you? Oh, that's okay. I've known some good poms. See you, mate. See you.
Lucifer stares at the flame-red horizon. He looks serious. He looks thoughtful and beautiful and wise. He smiles as if he's thought of something very funny indeed. He looks upwards at the sky.
All right. I admit it. He's got a point. The sunsets are bloody marvelous, you old bastard. Satisfied?
This is hell,
the Angel Duma thinks, looking out over an industrial wasteland where monstrous demons hunt their prey through a forest of industrial chimney stacks. Each chimney belches bilious green smoke, which mixes with the dark grey air of hell.
Smell the reek of burning fat in the air. Listen to the screams and the whimpers and the moans. Feel the pain.
Standing waist-deep in a pool of shit and water is a giant misshapen amphibian. It consists mostly of a sharp-toothed mouth into which it drops a naked man.
I never imagined it would be like this. Our realm of reflection. Our realm of shadow. Our little realm of pain. And we are kings. Or queens. Or angels.
The Angel Duma, wearing the key to hell on its chain, wings folded, stares out at the vista of pain and nightmare. Unmoving. Unreadable. Perfectly beautiful. Perfectly serene. Nearby, Remiel looks serenely out at the same view.
And what are you thinking, eh, Duma? Are you contemplating our new domain as once you contemplated the meaning of silence? Or the perfection of the name? I'm only here because of you. But perhaps it's a blessing. Perhaps it's an opportunity to do good. Has that occurred to you? In this place, every tiny act of goodness, of self-sacrifice or love, is magnified and becomes important. There is so much that we can do for them. So much.
A man hangs from a rock. His arms are tied above his head by a knot of worms. His chest is covered with welts and cuts. His face is a mask of pain and terror.
Bad boy! Take his medicine like a man!
The demon is a large, blocky creature. Its face and body a mess of pieces linked by chains and studs. It holds a barbed wire whip, which it uses to tear the flesh of its victim.
Free the skin from his chest! Listen to him squeak! Squeak, little mousey! Squeak to the heavens!
No!
Remiel has appeared, floating above the mud and ordure, looking at the demon with an expression of perfect love and peace. Arms slightly raised and apart, hands open. The angel radiates peace and love and perfection.
That was the old hell. That was a place of mindless torture and purposeless pain. There will be no more wanton violence. No further suffering inflicted without reason or explanation.
I don't understand.
We will hurt you, and we are not sorry. But we do not do it to punish you. We do it to redeem you. Because afterward, you'll be a better person. And because we love you, one day, you'll thank us for it.
You don't understand. That makes it worse. That makes it so much worse.
And the angel Remiel ascends into the sky of the underworld, confident that things have begun to change. To substitute redemption for damnation, correction for despair. Bit by bit, a little at a time, the billions of souls, the millions of demons. Remiel lands upon the balcony at the top of the Silver Tower. Dumas still gazes over the hellscape below.
With our presence here, Dumas, the flames of hell have become refining fires, burning away the dross, leaving purity and repentance and good.
Remiel hears the screams and smiles.
Oh, perhaps I judge too hastily. After all, this is part of the plan, is it not? Then how can it not be for the best? In this, the best of all possible worlds. Perhaps events have ended happily after all. Happily?
Never.
After? In hell.
Destiny walks in his garden of twisting paths, carrying the great brass-bound book which is chained to his wrist for all time.
How could events not be for the best in this, the best of all possible worlds? Perhaps things had ended happily after all. Happily ever after, in hell.
Destiny walks down one of the many paths which run straight and curved and forked through his garden. Mist on the ground swirls around his feet. As he walks, a passage from one of the books in his brother Morpheus's library comes to mind, a book that was never written or never finished, except in dreams. The Man Who Was October by G.K. Chesterton.
October knew, of course, that the action of turning a page, of ending a chapter, or of shutting a book did not end a tale. Having admitted that, he would also avow that happy endings were never difficult to find. It is simply a matter, he explained to April, of finding a sunny place in a garden where the light is golden and the grass is soft, somewhere to rest, to stop reading, and to be content.